Welcome to Leveraging Azure Active Directory Applications with Office 365, Single Sign-On, and Office Apps. I'm going to walk you through these topics using three different reference applications that demonstrate these different technologies. My name is Andrew Connell, and I built these samples that you'll see in this presentation in conjunction with Scott Hillier. The sample scenario is a project research tracker. The idea is that the web application makes it easy for users to create projects and add reference items found throughout the internet. The scenario demonstrates how to create different types of applications that communicate with Office 365 and SharePoint Online while keeping with recommended programming practices. All apps within this scenario follow a similar pattern. An Azure AD directory is used to facilitate single sign-on capabilities. Each app in the scenario is registered as an application within the Azure AD directory and granted permissions to Office 365, specifically SharePoint Online. Office 365, specifically SharePoint Online, is used to hold all the data that is stored and used within the different applications. Two lists will store all of the projects and project references within the application. There are a total of three apps that are going to be demonstrated throughout the scenario. First, a single page app, also known as a SPA, an SPA, that provides a rich browser-based experience. Second, an Office Outlook app that extracts links from an email and adds them to an existing project. And lastly, an Office Word app that lets a user select one or more references in a project and add them to a table in a Word document. Let's take a moment to talk a little bit about how Office 365 and SharePoint Online work for our scenario. All users within an Office 365 tenant are stored in an Azure AD directory. This Azure AD directory is no different from the directories that can be created and used within an Azure subscription. Customers can add their Office 365 Azure AD directory to their Azure subscription and even configure a user within that directory. Azure AD directories can be used to not only store users and facilitate authentication with Office 365, Azure, and custom applications, but they can also support creating custom applications. These applications can be granted permissions and configured to pass the identity of a user onto Office 365, either Exchange Online or SharePoint Online. Apps can also be configured with specific rights within the target, for example, Exchange Online or SharePoint Online, so that even if the user has permissions to do something in Office 365, the application can restrict what the Azure application is going to allow and pass through over to Office 365. This capability enables developers to create applications that can rely on the same Azure AD directory that powers the authentication of users in Office 365. Before we proceed, we need to talk about the OAuth access token. The Office 365 APIs and REST APIs in SharePoint Online require that every HTTP request include the access token in the header of the request. As such, your application will need to obtain an access token once they have authenticated with Azure AD. Access tokens are as good as cash in the sense that the holder of the token is not important in the call. Whoever has the token can use it, regardless of where they obtained it. Therefore, developers must exercise care in how they use and store access tokens. Now, there is a fairly split down the middle debate between the two different camps if it is okay to return the access token to the client, in our case the browser, for future calls. One side says that this process is okay as long as everything happens over HTTPS, because the access token is going to be protected in transport. The other side of the argument says that the access token should never touch the client, because if the client is compromised, it's irrelevant that the token was transported over HTTPS. Whoever has the token can then use it. Therefore, it's generally considered the safest practice to not distribute the access token to the client in clear text. For the sample scenario in this session, none of the apps will ever directly touch the access token in the client, and instead, the access token is never going to leave the server. Each sample application has an intermediary application, an ASP.NET web API project, that's going to store the access token it obtained from the Azure AD directory within a server-side session state. The clients authenticate and also send the session ID, as well as an anti-forgery token, to the ASP.NET web API project. These two things are used by Web API to retrieve the access token from session state for inclusion of any HTTP request that is sent to Office 365 using the Office 365 APIs or the SharePoint Online REST APIs. This way, the access token stays on the server-side solutions and never touches the client. Now let's take a minute to look at the intermediary ASP.NET Web API backend projects that will accompany each app. None of the client apps within this scenario, including the single-page application, the Office Outlook app, or the Office Word app, communicate directly with Office 365 or SharePoint Online. All communication with Office 365 and SharePoint Online is handled by an ASP.NET Web API backend intermediary process. The primary reason for this is to protect the OAuth2 access token that we previously discussed. In the case of a single-page application, the ASP.NET Web API project is also responsible for creating the two lists that are stored and used in all the apps in the solution. The two lists are created in the target SharePoint site if they're not already present. Let's look at how the authentication flow happens in the ASP.NET Web API projects. Some of the steps are omitted from the UML sequence diagram on this slide, but all the important ones you need to understand are depicted here. Everything starts with the user initially requesting the single-page web application. That's number one. That's configured to reject any non-authenticated requests or any anonymous requests. When it sees an anonymous request, as shown in number one on the slide, it responds, number two, with an HTTP 302 response, pointing to the URL of the Azure AD logon page. The browser then goes straight to Azure AD's logon page, this is number three, and enters the username and password for a user within the Azure AD directory. Assuming the authentication is successful, Azure AD responds, in number four, with the OAuth2 FedAuth cookies and SAML token that you typically receive when authenticating with an OAuth2 protected resource. The browser then tries the initial request again to the Web API project in number five to load the single page application, but this time it's going to include all the authentication headers and cookies. The Web API project will return the single page application web pages, but it's also going to request, as in number six, and retrieve an access token, which it'll get in number seven, from the Azure AD using the user's authentication data that was submitted. Once it receives this token, again in number 7, it stores it on the server-side session state, number 8, and returns the session ID and anti-forgery token, number 9, to the browser. These are the two values that the client will pass to the Web API project on future calls, the anti-forgery token and the session ID. The Web API project will use these to retrieve the access token from its server-side session state for use in future requests to Office 365 and SharePoint Online. Once the user authenticated, they then need to get data from SharePoint Online's REST API or submit creates, updates, and deletes. As we explained on the previous slide, this starts by the single page application or the Office app when it issues an HTTP GET, as in number one on the slide, to the Web API project. Within this HTTP request, the anti-forgery token and session state ID are included in the header. The Web API project uses these values to retrieve the access token from the session state. The Web API project then issues an HTTP GET or a POST, a DELETE, or MERGE request to the Office 365 API or SharePoint Online REST APIs, as in number two in the UML diagram. And it's going to include the access token with the authorization header. Office 365 or SharePoint Online will respond accordingly in number three in the UML diagram. And that response essentially passes through Web API straight back to the client, as in number four. The first thing that we will need to do is create an Azure Active Directory application. This is going to be used by the sample applications in the code. Let's jump over to the GitHub code repository. If you look at the README file and the root of this application in this code repository, what you'll see is it lists out the different applications. There's the single page app, the Office app, and the Word app. Each one of these is going to have a README file, a README.md file, that's going to point and give you all the instructions on how to set up the application. At the very bottom, there's a little note here on creating Azure applications. You could create a single Azure application and use it for all the code samples, but these are supposed to be reference implementations. And so we've created a separate app for each one of these, just to make sure that everything is as real world as you would want it to be. But know that you can, if you're doing development, you can just leave it as one single Azure app. Inside of each one of these, inside of each one of the applications, what you'll find within the source file for the projects, like for example, this is the single page app one, the SP Research Tracker. The README file in here is going to contain all the information on how to set up Azure. We're going to run through this sample right now. I'm not going to walk through the actual README file because I already have everything up and running. What I've done ahead of time is I have an Office 365 tenant. That tenant, all of the users in that tenant are backed in a Azure Active Directory directory. That directory has been added to my Azure subscription, and as you see it here, that's listed. It's going to list all of my users, and if I jump over to the applications, it shows all the applications I've created. Let's go create a new application. I'm going to go into the bottom and click the Add button. And the first thing I'm going to choose is add an application my organization is developing. I'm going to go ahead and give this one a name, like My Azure AD App. And then I have to choose what kind of an app it is. I'm going to say this is a web application and or a web API. And then I'll click Next. The sign-on URL property is the URL where the ASP.NET application is going to reside. So I'm going to go over to Visual Studio. I'm going to look at my SP Research Tracker project from the code base. I'm going to look at its properties. And I'm going to see that the sign-on URL is https://localhost:443.62. So I'm going to grab that. And I'll come back over to the browser and I'll paste it in. Now, if you're going to go use additional applications, or if you're going to deploy this to Azure websites, you're going to want to make sure you plug in the right URL there. The next thing I want to do is give my app some sort of an ID. So I'm going to choose https://acon.onmicrosoft.com/sp-research-tracker. And it shows that this is already being used in the same directory. So I'm just going to throw a 2 on the end of this because I know that that's not being used. And I'll go ahead and check that off. So what it's doing now is it's creating the application. I'm going to come over here to the dashboard. It shows a little bit of information about the app, but not a whole lot of stuff that we can use here. Let's jump over to the Configure tab because that's where we're going to want to do a lot of work. Now, we're going to want to keep track of a lot of these things we've typed in. So I'm going to open up a little text editor here, and we're going to go ahead and record a lot of the things that we've been using. So for instance, I know that the site or the sign-on URL was localhost:443.62. I also know that the ID for my app was https://acon.onmicrosoft.com/sp-research-tracker2. The next thing we're going to need to do is we need to get the client ID for our app. That's defined inside of the app that was created. If I scroll down, we'll see the client ID listed. We're going to need that, so I'm going to copy it, and I'll keep track of that as well. Now I need to go create a key associated with my app. So from here, I'm going to create a key. I'll say it's good for a year, and you'll see that it says the value will be displayed after I save it. So I'm going to save my changes. And there's the key. Keep note of this little message here. It says copy and store the key value. You're not going to be able to retrieve it after you leave the page. If I actually leave the page, I'll come back and this will be all masked out. I won't be able to have access to this key anymore. So I'd have to create a new key. In this case here, I'm going to go ahead and save this key so that we can use it later. The next step is to go ahead and give the application some permissions. So I'm going to scroll down a little bit and give it permissions. So I'm going to pick SharePoint Online, and I'll come over here to SharePoint Online and say that this app can create or delete items and lists in all the site collections. Of course, the user would still have to have permissions to do this, but this is just saying what the app can do. Can edit or delete items, and it can read items. We'll go ahead and save those changes. And with that, our application has now been created. So now we can go jump over and start looking at some of the different solutions. You're going to need to do the same process for all of the different apps. The README files instruct you on different reply URLs that you'll need to specify in here. So we're only going to do this once, but just know the other apps. Refer to the documentation for the other solutions and the other samples for what other URLs you're going to need to add in. The first app in this scenario is a single-page application, also known as a SPA. The SPA is a web application that generally does not have page refreshes. Rather, portions of the page are swapped in and out with HTML fragments depending on the current screen. All data is submitted and retrieved from the server, in this case, web API using AJAX calls. The non-refreshing user experience is implemented using various open source JavaScript libraries, such as AngularJS and Breeze, among many others. In addition to the SPA, the web app also includes a bookmarklet. A user can drag this to their favorites bar in the browser for later use. Then, when they're on another web page that they want to add as a reference in the project, they can click on the bookmarklet in their favorites bar, and it will open a new window where they can quickly add the reference to an existing project. The key precept of the SPA is that it must be responsive and mobile-friendly. In fact, this one was built with a mobile-first approach. As you can see from the screenshots on this slide, the experience is modified based on the width of the browser so that the same web application codebase will work in a desktop browser or all the way down to a narrow form factor like a phone browser. This was facilitated using the popular Bootstrap library and augmented using the Angular UI Bootstrap project. The latter rewrites some of the Bootstrap elements in pure Angular code. As previously mentioned, the SPA is implemented with various open source JavaScript libraries. This slide contains a list of all the libraries that we used. First, jQuery is used for a few DOM manipulation pieces. Angular actually relies on jQuery if it's present, but if it isn't, Angular actually includes a subset of jQuery that is implemented by the Angular team and included in Angular called jQLite. Next, the most popular user interface components, including buttons, tables, dialogues, these are all implemented using the popular Bootstrap library. All single-page applications have common characteristics like navigation, routing, histories, data binding, templating, and many more things, to name a few. While you can create all of this on your own, most developers leverage presentation frameworks, which is why AngularJS is used here. AngularJS, an open source project by Google with a very robust and active ecosystem, is a single-page app presentation framework. While not necessary, this sample app also uses the UI Bootstrap library. This is an Angular implementation of the Bootstrap library, allowing for some easy ways to implement some controls in the Bootstrap library. The majority of the data access with the server is handled using a library called Breeze. If you're familiar with the Entity framework, you can think of Breeze as a JavaScript implementation, and thus a client-side implementation of Entity Framework. It simplifies calls to REST APIs, adds client-side data validation, client-side caching, and a whole lot more. When the SPA has to retrieve or submit data to the server for processing, we usually want to lock the user interface so that the user doesn't do something while the application is busy. For this, the spin.js library helps with this in adding a little spinner-like busy notification to show that the application is currently working. And finally, we're using the Toaster library to create notifications that appear in the upper right corner of the application when items are created, updated, deleted, or just to notify the user of something. Now let's take a look at the single-page application sample that's part of this scenario. If I go into Visual Studio and I look at the SP Research Tracker project, specifically the web config, what you'll see is in the app settings section, a bunch of these replace tokens. They're all over the place. They're here in the app settings and they're also farther down in the web config. What these are references to your Office 365 tenant, your Azure tenant, your Azure Active Directory application that you created, and the SharePoint site that contains the list that are going to store all the data. If you go back and look at the GitHub repository for this sample, specifically if you look at the README files, there's a sample table in each one of the README files that references all the sample values that you would want to be collecting. As you go through creating the Azure application, it'll tell you to update these different values in the tables above. At the very bottom of this setup, there's a section that talks about configuring the ASP.NET web application, and it lists all of the different line numbers and the settings that you need to update with the values that you need to update. So you're going to need to go ahead and do this stuff for each one of the web applications inside of each one of the samples in this scenario. I've gone ahead and done this just to save a little bit of time. So here, if you look at the web config inside of Visual Studio, you'll see that I've gone through and updated all of my settings to point to my Office 365 tenant. There's the key and the client ID for the Azure application, all the information that we needed. Furthermore, there's also a URL here. And if I go look at the URL, this site does not contain the two lists for projects and references. What's going to happen when I first launch this site or launch my web application and the single page app is it's going to try and authenticate. And then once it authenticates, it's then going to try and get references to those two lists. If the lists don't exist, it'll go ahead and create them at that time and obtain those references. So let's go ahead and sign out just to get a very clean experience here when we go to launch our application. Okay, so we've now successfully signed out. Let's come back over here to Visual Studio, and I'll go ahead and launch the application by just clicking on the Start button. So what this is going to do is it's going to try and hit the application. I'm not going to be authenticated, so it's going to kick me back and force me to authenticate. So you can see here that it's first prompting me to authenticate, so I'll go ahead and do that. And I'm using my Office 365 / Azure Active Directory application credentials. Now this initializing screen is taking an extra second here to get going because it's having to create those two SharePoint lists. We can confirm that by coming over to our site, and we should see our project and our references list show up. And sure enough, we do. There's projects and there's references. They don't contain anything yet. That's fine because we haven't added anything. So let's go over and let's actually use the application. So I'll click on this project list reference first, and we'll go to create a brand new project, such as Learn Office 365 Development. And I'll click Save. And it says it's saving the project. You see it even lists over here the little toast notification that the project was saved. If I come back and click on the application here, we'll see that I have no references. Well, I know that a good reference for this is going to be http://dev.office.com. I don't need to put the title in here because if I leave this title out, the sample application will grab the title of the target URL and use that automatically. Some comments, I'll just have this be a great starting point. And hit save. And now it's saving a reference for our project. And now we see it listed right here. Just to confirm that we're getting data over here in our SharePoint site, I'll refresh this page and go into our projects list. And sure enough, we see Learn Office 365 Development. And if I go over to references, we'll see our Office Dev Center homepage, that's the title of dev.office.com, with the notes that we entered in. So that's pretty neat. Let's come back over here to the research tracker and let's add another one in. So I'll add in another reference here. You see this little required dialog showing up over here on the right hand side. That's coming from Breeze, the Breeze JavaScript library. What we did, I'll show you in the code, is that we actually set some validation rules that say that this is a required field. So this little decoration that's happening is kind of going on automatically for us. Another good site that I know that we can check out is office.microsoft.com, and we'll just call this the Office Microsoft homepage. And then I'll go ahead and click save. Go ahead and save that reference. And we'll go back to our project list. And we can see that all of our references are going to show up here just the way we've listed them. Now another thing that we can do is we can even edit these. So if I come over here and click on the little pencil icon and put some comments here. Notice the comments are showing up behind the scenes over here, and that's because we're modifying a entity that is data bound to both this dialogue and to the list over here. If I hit cancel, my changes are not persisted. But if I come back over here and enter my changes in, like some comments go here and then hit save, those changes will be persisted over to the SharePoint list. Now, another cool little thing that we can do with this, if I come back to the home page for my application, what you'll see is I have this little bookmarklet down here. If I grab this bookmarklet and put it up in my favorites bar, and then let's say I navigate over to another resource like HTTPS, GitHub, let's go to the Office Dev GitHub account. If I click on Project Reference right here, it'll open up a little dialog for me to go in and create a project reference. So it'll let me pick a project. It'll say Office Dev. This will be the GitHub Office organization. And we'll just leave the comments in. I'll hit save and it'll save that reference and the dialog will go away. But if I come back over to our list of projects and look at this project that was created, you'll see it was even listed right here, making it really easy to use this. Okay, now let's take a look at the code. Now let's take a look at the code solution inside of Visual Studio for our single page application now that we've seen it work. This application is set up to not allow anonymous users. If I come over here and look at the controllers, inside of the home controller, what you'll see here is that when I first go to hit the site, the home controller is going to redirect me and make sure that I have authenticated first. So it's going to do this little redirection process right here. That's going to ultimately go back and forth between Azure Active Directory and have me authenticate and then come back to the site, saving my credentials and such. The redirect where I'm ultimately going to come back is over here to the spa view. Now, part of this process of the whole redirection that's going on is using this thing called the OAuth controller.cs, this code file controller that shows up here. This is coming from an existing Microsoft project. If I come over here to HTTPS GitHub Azure AD samples web app web API OAuth 2 user identity .net, what you'll see is that inside of this project, there's a controller here called the OAuth controller, and it's just a sample that Microsoft provides for doing the OAuth authentication stuff, and we just grabbed it from that. So this isn't anything special. This goes through and does all the authentication back with Azure Active Directory. When you come back, it grabs the access token, it stores that in a session state, and it's going to ultimately return back to the user the session ID and the anti-forgery token to ensure that everything is nice and secure going forward. So that's just how the authentication happens, and we talked a little bit about in the slides about the actual flow, so I'm not going to dwell too much on that. We have other controllers here for projects. We have them for references as well. Those are all primarily being used just to handle the read and write support from the single page application back to the web API, which then makes the call back to SharePoint REST API on behalf of the single page app. With that, it's going to be using the access token that we don't want to have shared with our end users. So all that stuff is happening behind the scenes. So if I look inside of my views folder, underneath shared, under layout, what we'll see here at the very top for the shared layout for all the views is this data-ng-app, and then I've given my app a name called app. that effectively is going to bind, is going to use Angular to bind an app, a module called app, to the entire page. So that's going to effectively turn into my single page application. If I scroll down a little bit farther, what you will see is I then have a section here that says render the body of the page out. Well, the body of the page, we're going to be going to home/spa. So if I look at the spa-cshtml, it's going through and it's writing out a little include declaration directive to Angular that says go load the shell.html file. That's the core of where our application is going to reside. And I'll show you that in just a moment. The other thing it's doing here is it's creating a hidden input tag called the request verification token. And it's using a server-side script to go fetch that token. And it's getting that those values from our web API. That's the token that it's creating or that it's obtaining. It's doing it from a cookie. It's grabbing the anti-forgery token and the session ID. This is something that we're going to use in every single request we send over to the web API from our single page application. So the entire single page application resides inside of this app folder. The scripts folder is what I use for third-party JavaScript libraries. So think of this as like a managed applications references folder. Up here inside the app folder is where the entire single page app resides. So we're not going to walk through the entire single page app. Instead, I just want to walk through the pieces of it that show how it gets initialized and bootstrapped and loaded, and then how we do some read and write operations back to web API that'll then interact with the SharePoint REST API on our behalf. Everything is going to start, as I mentioned, with this. We have a file called shell.html. Shell.html, we have a little splash page, some nice little animation stuff that we're doing here, but the important part is right down here. This directive data-ng-view is telling Angular that whatever view we're currently on, this is where you should load it. The shell view also has an associated controller called shell. That primarily is just managing the busy state for the page and if we should show the splash page as well. Now, before we can look at the view, we have to see how the whole application loads. Inside of the main layout for our MVC application, we have this script file called app.js, and this is the core role of serves the core role of bootstrapping our single page application. What it does first is it creates a new Angular module called app, and then it loads in a couple libraries. It loads in the ng-route, which is used for routing support in Angular. It has the sanitize service, which is also going to be loading in or cleaning up some of our data binding with HTML. Also giving us some animation capabilities to give our application a nice smooth transition between screens. UI Bootstrap is the Angular UI Bootstrap project that rewrites some of the Bootstrap controls in a pure Angular code. And then we have a couple modules here for Breeze, which we'll go, I'll take a look at when we start getting into data access. All right, so that's app.js. After app.js loads in the browser, it then loads a config.js file. Config.js is going to get a reference to our app, and then it goes through and sets some global configuration things that we want inside of our application, such as configuring the toast notifications. We have some global events that are being broadcast, some global properties that we want to define in a bunch of places, such as our events. And then we're also wiring up our log provider to get to tell Angular we want all debug messages to be emitted. And then also to wire up our events to our common configuration. These are standard single page app patterns. We're not gonna dive into how to create single page applications. I simply wanna show you how this application is loading and reading and writing stuff back to SharePoint. There's a lot of different single page app presentation frameworks. Aside from just using something like Angular, there's other ones like Backbone and Ember. We don't want to dwell too much on the Angular piece in this session. The next thing we have here is this routing file. So the config.route is going to define all of the different routes that are supported in our application. In here, I'm going to first get a reference to our Angular application. I'm then going to define a new global constant called routes that's going to get populated by this getRoutes function. If we scroll down and look at that, you can just see that I'm creating a bunch of objects here that say if we're at the home page, go load the template called dashboard.html, and the title is dashboard. If we're inside of the projects page, go ahead and load the template app/projects/list.html, and the title of it is projects. This is kind of nice here. This little notation by putting a colon and then a name after it, that says that I have a wildcard that's going to go there, like a name or an integer. So when I look at projects/1, I'm going to write the controller for the detail view to say, go grab the project ID parameter being passed in. We're going to use that as the ID. So we'll see how that's used in just a moment. Once I've loaded all my routes, I'm then going to look at the route provider, and I'm going to run through this thing called a route configurator. The route configurator is going to look at all the routes that have been provided, and it's going to say when you find this URL, it's going to pass back this configuration object, and that configuration object is telling it the URL of the view to go load. You'll notice here that I'm not referencing the controller. We'll see how that's getting referenced later. Finally, if we're trying to reference a URL or a screen in our single page app that doesn't exist, we're just going to redirect to the root of the page. Now let's take a look at what happens when I go to my project list page. So the way that this the single page app folders are structured is that the layout folder contains our shared view stuff. So we had a shared header or a shared footer or a shared navigation or the shell of the application, I traditionally put all of my stuff inside the layout folder. I then have a common folder for, you guessed it, common libraries. And then I have a separate folder for each section of my application or each view and primary and secondary views. So like the dashboard has his dashboard view and his controller associated with it. The project section here, projects, has a couple views and a couple controllers. So I have a view, which is list.html for the all of my items, all of my projects that come back. I have a detail view, which is used for the dialogue to see an individual project. And then the detail edit, which is used for the actual dialogue, modal dialogue, to go edit everything. So everything related to a project is in my projects folder. Let's look at the project list view first. The project list view is just listing out all of our projects. So we can see our projects listed here. I can also see that, you know, if I want to click on add a new project, I have some events that are set up, and we'll look at that in just a minute. But a little bit farther down, let's get a list of all the projects. What I'm doing is I'm looking at using a Angular directive called repeat that says for each project in the collection vm.projects, go ahead and write out the current project's title. Now, where's this VM coming from? Well, the pattern that I'm using here is at the very top, I have a controller directive that says use a controller named project list and reference it throughout this view as something called VM. So what I'm doing then, what Angular is going to do is it's going to look for a controller named project list. Well, on the home page of the application, I loaded all the JavaScript files that were needed in the application. So if we look at list.js, we can see that it defined a new Angular module or new controller for my app named project list. This project list is having using the Angular's dependency injection. I'm injecting in a bunch of other modules and services and factories. And then I'm going to say, once you've done that, the constructor for this controller is named project list. So here's project list right here. I'm then getting a reference to my controller by just saying, creating a variable inside this controller called VM, and I'm attaching it to this. I've then set up a couple functions here, global functions, like what happens when I click the go new project or go refresh or go project detail. If you remember from the view we looked at just a minute ago, You saw when I want to create a new project, I have a vm.go new project. What does that do? Go new project, if I scroll down to what go new project does, go new project is using the Bootstrap modal dialogues to create a modal dialog and specifying that the view for it is something called myprojectmodalcontent.html. We'll look at that in just a moment. First, let's see, scroll back at the top. After, once my application, once the controller is running through this, the constructor part of the controller, I call the init function, which is just gonna broadcast a message that says, go to my common library and broadcast this message that I'm gonna activate a controller. What that's doing is this central activate controller is gonna emit an event throughout my application that says the controller has been activated. Once it's run through all of the different promises that have been executed, which will tell it to shut down the animation for the loading or the busy animation. So let's look at get all projects. Get all projects first sets the busy animation to say I'm loading projects in the application. It then is going to return a promise using my data context, saying, calling the function on my data context of get projects. Once that completes, it's going to bind the projects collection on the current view model, the current controller, equal to the data that came back from my data context. That's how in my view, I'm able to say vm.projects and go bind all those different items. So again, let's look at the controller. In the controller, we want to see how am I actually getting all this data back. So let's go over to the data context. That's going to be found inside my services folder, specifically datacontext.breeze. Now, Breeze is a library that's going to help you work with REST APIs. It's going to make it much easier to write queries. It's going to make it much easier to read and write data to a REST API. It's also going to give you some client-side caching capabilities. And so we've elected to use that in this sample. You don't have to use Breeze. You could use the out-of-the-box HTTP service or the resource service that comes with Angular or any other data access that you would like. Let me show you why we like Breeze and what it's giving us. So Breeze is being set up as a factory in Angular, and we're calling it Data Context Breeze. If I scroll down a little bit, you can see that I am referencing or returning back the public signature for my data context, and one of those functions on it is called getProjects. If I scroll down a little bit, if I look at getProjects, what getProjects is doing is it's first going to try and see if we've already loaded projects or if I'm doing a forced refresh of all my projects. So if I'm not doing either one of those, like if I've already gone through and gotten projects at the very beginning of when my app loaded, or if I'm telling it that I don't want to do a forced refresh, then what I'm doing here is in Breeze, I can say, go create an entity query where you're going to look for all the projects, sort them by their title, use a thing called Entity Manager, which you can see up above in my initialization function. I'm actually creating a reference to it up here. Again, we'll see what that is in just a minute. And then I'm going to say, try and execute the query locally. Now, what that's going to do is it's going to say, go look for all the projects locally in the local Breeze cache on the client. If you find projects, then don't go to the server. Just return those back to the client. So we're saving a round trip. However, if you don't already have stuff, then I want you to automatically go back and get data back from the backend data service. So what this execute query does is it lets you look for stuff locally before running back to the server. This requires a little bit of setup stuff. So what you see here at the very beginning is I did have this config.breeze. So what is this? Config.breeze loads at the very beginning of my application. And his job is to do a few things. He's going to return back instances of my entity manager and a data service. First thing I have to do is initialize this guy. And what I'm going to do is first tell Breeze what data service you're going to be using. This is similar to working with ADO.NET and saying you're using a SQL database or an Oracle database or some other sort of database, I'm telling Breeze, we're working with Web API OData. And Breeze knows how to talk to Web API OData. Once that's done, I then need to go ahead and initialize this guy. So I'm initializing the Entity Manager. I'll show you what that does. So if I scroll down to my init entity manager, what this is going to do is it's first going to go in and create a data service for my entity manager. Or it's going to create a new instance of my entity manager and also pass back my data service. So let's look at my getting the data service. Here's my data service right here. It's passing back an object with a property called service name that's pointing to our endpoint for our OData service in Web API, which is just the current URL slash OData. Then it's creating my entity manager. Now what we want my entity manager to do is we want it to first go get all the metadata for my OData service, for my Web API OData service, because that will tell Breeze what all the different data types look like, what all the entities look like. And it usually does this on the very first query, but if I'm doing a deep link to go create a brand new item, then I won't be doing any queries back to the REST API until I try and save the item. And if Breeze doesn't know about the data types and the different properties and some validation stuff, when it goes to the new field, go to create a new project, I'm going to have a couple, not errors show up, but I'm going to lose some of the rich data validation stuff that I could do. I'm also going to lose any of the ability to do any kind of identity mapping for telling Breeze what are the identity fields. This is stuff that you usually don't have to do when you're working with Breeze and server-side stuff, but in this case here, I don't own the server-side data. SharePoint owns the data, and I'm just using Web API to act as an intermediary for authentication and protecting my access token. So I'm telling Breeze to first go fetch the metadata from my OData endpoint, and then I need to configure the identities and also attach the validators. So with this, I'm not going to dwell too much on this, but when I say config the identities, I'm just going to look at my project and my reference types, and I'm going to tell it that they have auto-generated keys. We're not creating the keys ourselves. All right? So it doesn't need to worry about those identities. For doing the validation stuff, you see here that I'm getting a reference to my project data type. Then I'm looking at the title property and I'm adding a new validator that says this is a required field. There are other validators that Breeze provides, such as it's a URL field to make sure it's a valid URL. There's also ones for email and max length of strings and stuff like that. So once I've gone through and fetched the metadata, now my entity manager is finished. Initialization of the entity manager is finished. So if we scroll back up, you see here that I also want to say, let's configure the default client that entity manager is using to make calls back to my REST API. So I'm saying configure the default client, and then I'm also going to fix up metadata. Well, what do these two things do? Well, if I look at the configure my default HTTP client, this right here is where I'm telling Breeze to say every time you make a request, you need to include a header called request verification token that's coming from that hidden form field that's added to the page that includes the anti-forgery token and the session state so that my web API knows where to look for the access token. Once I've created this secure client, I'm going to replace the Breeze client that's being used with this, which is data.js's OData object. I'm going to replace the default HTTP client with the secured client that we create. The last thing here was the fixing up of the metadata. What the fix up metadata processing function is doing is that it's doing a little workaround to an issue that the Web API implementation in ASP.NET has. Web API does support batch operations with OData, as does Breeze, but we're including some things inside of each one of the batch operations, such as e-tags to ensure consistency with the data. These e-tags are not looked at all the time by Web API. And so what we did is we wanted to make sure that the e-tags were included in not only in the top level batch request, but in each of the individual requests inside of the batch request. So this is just doing a little bit of cleanup and some fix up stuff for us. Let's go back to our data context. So this just showed us how we got multiple projects. You can see here that if I needed to get data from the server, like if I did a force refresh, or if the projects were not initially loaded, then I'm saying go get data from the server. And I do that by simply calling the execute function instead of calling the execute locally function. Once that's done, I then have a little flag that says, yes, we've loaded all of our projects by default. And now go ahead and return the results back. So what happens if I want to look at an individual item? Well, if I want to go to an individual item, if you recall, the route pointed to the project/default view. So default view is going to list out my title, and then it lists out all of the references as well. So I'm including a list of references and then also the stuff for editing a project. If I look at the detailview.js file, what you'll see is I'm passing in a Angular service called routeParams. RouteParams is going to give me access to the project ID. That's the key that was included inside of the header of our application, or inside the URL of our application. So I could go to /projects/1, and it would know that I'm looking for a specific project number one. So here, I'm going to say, go get an item of project one. This simply uses the data context to say, go get a project ID by ID number one. And there's the ID that I'm passing in. If I then go back and look at the data context, well, I've more than likely already gotten the data because I'm looking at going from my master list to my master list of projects to the detail view. So what I can say is that go look at the entity manager, go fetch an entity by a key, specifically go look for the project entity using this ID, and true says try to find it in the local cache. If you do find it in the local cache, then return that. If you don't find it, then go to the server and try and find it. Because Breeze already knows how to talk to the server when it fetched all the metadata, we don't need to write all the extra server-side code. All the code that we would need to go call the REST API. How do I go about creating objects? Well, you can see down here inside of my data context. Let's go find our data context. And this is where we can create our projects. We have another one that's creating references that's very similar to this. I can pass in any initial values, so I can set the title or whatever if I want to. But generally what I'm gonna do with this is I'm first gonna create a new entity in Breeze called a project type. So I'm gonna say entityManager.metadatastore.getEntityType. I'm looking for a specific project. That will give me back the project. I'm then gonna go create an entity called project. Now I have a real entity I can put data in. I'm going to define the data type using the OData format and Breeze format to say this is the kind of data that we're looking for, and then hand the entity back. That gets bound to the edit form, and then as the values are plugged in, like the title or the URL or the description, once I then want to save my changes, all I have to do is say save changes, and it doesn't matter what kind of entity it is. Breeze knows what the different data types are. It knows what a project is. It knows what the project endpoint is, and it knows how to save those. If I ever want to cancel my changes, I simply just say entityManager.rejectChanges, and it dismisses everything. If you've used Entity Framework before on the server, this is a very similar pattern where you create the objects, you then make your changes to it, and then you save those changes that get persisted back to the databases. One thing that's a little bit different is if you want to delete an entity, you have to first get a reference to that entity and then set him to deleted and then save your changes. So that's a little overview on our single page application that shows how it gets data, how it initializes everything, how it fetches data using a data context, and how it gets a single item and then creates, updates, saves, and deletes items. The next app we will look at is the Outlook web app. This Office app is installed within the Outlook web application. It detects a URL within the current email, and it shows the app Research Tracker in the app menu bar. Clicking on this will open a little window, which allows the user to select an existing project and all the links found within the email that they want to add to the project. Like the SPA, all communication between the Outlook web app and SharePoint Online's REST API are going to go through a backend web API project to protect the access token. Now let's take a look at the Office web application plugin that's going to work with the Office web app. Inside of the Visual Studio solution, you'll find two projects, Outlook Research Tracker and Outlook Research Tracker Web. What I've done is I had to go in and modify the web config, which had a bunch of values that needed to get replaced, just like the single page application. Again, it works the exact same, where you're just going to use the same kind of properties that are all defined inside of the README inside the GitHub repository for these projects. We're not going to take too much time here to look at the web project. It works almost the exact same way as the SharePoint project that we saw, or the single page app project that we saw in the previous demo. I just want to show you a little bit of how this app project works. So the first thing we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and start a new instance of my project. We need our website set up. And that's okay because we're not going to this homepage of the URL. Now, let me come over here and let me launch our Research Tracker application. It's going to ask me to go ahead and authenticate into my Office 365 tenant and my subscription, specifically for my Office web application to go look at my mail. What you'll see is I here have one email inside of my inbox. And what it's done is it's found this email contains one link inside of it, https://managewindowsazure.com. You'll see that I have this research tracker that's showing up. This is my app. If I click on this, it was activated and it shows up as an option because it found a link of HTTPS. So what it's doing here is it first authenticated and then went back to an ASP.NET page or a web page that lives inside of the website that we started up a moment ago. When I pick the different research projects, it'll show all the different research projects that we have in our application. It'll show all of the links that it found inside this email so that I can pick a link and then come back and say, add the link to the project. And so what it's doing now is it's using the web API project that we created to go write the link to our references list inside of the SharePoint site. And we can see that that worked by going to our Research Tracker site. And if I go to references, we see the one that was created. And of course, it used the title of the page that it found, the title of that of manage.windowsazure.com is just continue. It's probably because it's a redirect, but you can see here that it actually grabbed the link that we put in, and it even puts in a little list here that it was created by Outlook. So how does this work? Let me go ahead and close this out. What I have here is inside of my Office app, if I open up the manifest, you'll see it's got a name here, a research tracker, and it's of type mail app. If I scroll down a little bit, you see that the permissions it has is just read item. It doesn't need to do anything to my mailbox other than just read the current email. If I go over to the read form, you'll see that I'm specifying what this thing can do. When will this item be activated? Or when will this add-in show up inside of my application? I can see when the item is a message and when it matches a specific regular expression. And in this case here, you can see that it was only looking for links that start with HTTPS. The compose form, we're not doing anything here. The app domains are the list of all the URLs that should be allowed to be loaded by my application. In this case here, I need to use the login.windows.net and login.microsoftonline.com because that's the Windows Azure Active Directory and Office 365 authentication URLs. So if I jump back over to the Read Form tab and scroll down, you'll see what's the UI settings for my add-in. And I'm pointing to a site or a path here called Outlook Research Tracker Web /home. So that's going to this project right here. If I look at his views, he has a view called home, index.chtml, but it's actually going to be pointing to app.chtml. And if I open this up, this is just giving me all the UI associated with my application. This is just standard ASP.NET MVC web form or MVC stuff. So we're not going to dive into this. If I scroll down a little bit, the part that's the Office web app is this JavaScript down at the bottom. And what this is doing here is it's finding it's going through and it's writing out the URL, the user interface to show us all of the projects and all of the references. And writing all of that stuff out and then knowing how that when I actually say I want to add the reference, it's then going to go run this function here to go through and say add the reference. What that's going to then do is do some stuff on the server side to tell this controller there's my get and then here's the post to actually go create a new reference and submit that reference over to the SharePoint REST API. It does that using this repository object where if you go in the models, you can take a look at how we've done the repositories and looking at the reference repository to see how all these different items are being added to our SharePoint site. The last app in the scenario is an add-in for the desktop version of Microsoft Office Word. When installed, it adds a task pane to Word called the Research Tracker. After logging in, the user can pick an existing project and then one or more references found within the project. After selecting the references, when the user clicks a link within the task pane, a new table is added to the current Word document with the name of the project and all the selected references. Now let's take a look at the Word add-in. Again, just like the other projects, we had to go update the web config inside of our web project, which is going to reference things like the Office app and the site URL where our lists are storing all of our projects and references. If I come over here to the actual add-in and open up the manifest, we'll see here that this is a task pane app called Research Tracker. If I scroll down a little bit, you'll see that the source location for where this starts is pointing over here to our home path or home route. What permissions does this app have? It can write to the document. It can both read and write to the document. If I come over here to activation, this shows that this application can run inside of Word 2013 RTM and Service Pack 1. App domains is going to list out the different domains of where I need to be able to authenticate for my Word application. So, let's go in and let's start this up. I first run our web project, which again, we'll get a bad link here at first, which is just fine because we're not going to be going to this page anyway. And then I'll come back over and I'll start up a new instance of the Word Research Tracker. So there we can see our research tracker is showing up on the right-hand side in the task pane. And what it's first doing is it's checking to see if we're authenticated. So it might already detect that we're authenticated, and it does, so we don't have to authenticate. If I was not authenticated, we would have a little dialog over there to log in to Office 365 or Azure Active Directory. We only have one research project, so we'll see that one research project show up. The idea here is that I can pick multiple items from my research project. In this case, we'll pick three of the four. I'll put my cursor up here at the top of the page. And if I scroll down, I'll say insert selected link information. And what that'll do is just create a little table inside of my Word document with all the references coming from our project. So let's take a look and see how this is done. If I come over into my web project, I look at the views for my app CSHTML and scroll down to the code, we'll see that all I'm doing is I'm down here on the insert links. When I click the link, or when I click the link said insert references, that's going to create a table. So you can see I'm getting a reference to a table over here inside of the task pane, and it's grabbing all of the different items that have been selected. It's then going to create an HTML table on line 118, and then it's going to walk through all of the different items that were selected and create new table rows for them. At the very end of that, it's then going to use the Word and Office API to create, go office.context.document, set selected data asynchronously, and it's going to write out some HTML to our page. So there's the table we want to create, and it's going to write it out as HTML to the Word document. And that's how we're updating the Word document. I hope that you see how some of these different apps and these different patterns can be used in some of your applications. Specifically, we saw how we can actually create apps using Azure Active Directory, and we can give them permissions within Office 365. These apps did not need any special permissions within SharePoint or any special configurations within Office 365. We simply leverage the same single sign-on process that's facilitated using Azure Active Directory. Now, not all of the code was shown in all of these different samples. We wanted to focus on the highlighted parts. This is particularly true with a single page application. We couldn't go through the entire single page application and explain how every little bit about AngularJS and Breeze and how to create single page applications in this. We just wanted to show a process for creating a client-side application. We focused on the highlights of the SPA, not every single screen. However, this code is all available to you. And so you can download this and you can take a look at it at your discretion. Thanks a lot. Hope you got something out of this, and we'll see you next time.